thank you, Celine. Thank you for this introduction. So I'll present myself. I'm called Corinne Doria. I'm a white woman. I have short, dark hair. I'm wearing glasses with my purple top. I'm 44. I'm Italian. And I'm wearing a black tank top. It's very hot in Milan, where I live and where I'm speaking to you from. And so I'm going to be chairing this session, this 11th round table of, in this conference. And as Celine said, we're going to be listening to three speakers who will be giving their papers. Gildas Bréguin, first of all, and then Raquel Guerrero and Virginia Kastrup. And so, first of all, I'm going to present Gildas Bréguin, who is a historian and a researcher at the CNRS with the Arends Laboratory, which is part of the ESP in Rennes. His research is translational research in disabilities in the 20th century. He's particularly in focused on the three countries in Latin America, and then Algeria, Tunisia, and Western Europe, including France and Spain. And so he's the first speaker in the round table, which is on feminist approaches to blindness, discrimination, resistance, and fighting for the rights of blind people in metropolitan France from the early 1900s to 1945. Thank you, Corinne. So I'm Gildas Bréguin. I'm French. I have short brown hair. I'm 38. I'm wearing a black shirt and grey glasses. And so I'm doing research on the history of blind people, in particular blind women, during the first half of the 20th century. And I'm particularly interested in the life experiences of white blind women and the different experiences in and what they did to improve their lot in life in that period of history. I'm carrying on the work that was begun by Catherine Kubrick and Zina Vegan. And so the research in social sciences was on the experience of blind women, and that looks at they suffer from the combined effects of two systems of oppression, which is oculocentrism. And for several years, I've been looking at the archives of associations to have a better understanding of the fights for the rights of blind women. And I've had a number of difficulties to transcribe the purpose of the research to more for a major region, which is that most of the action taken to improve the lot of blind women, it doesn't fall within the political fight for rights. Most of the actions that I can see, historically speaking, are more actions which are within institutions, requests to the directors, or other actions which could be considered to be minor, and they're not political striving or debates at national or international conferences. But that aspect does exist, but it's a very minor compared to all the other actions that women have undertaken to improve their lot in life. And so now I'm going to talk, as I only have 5 minutes, I'm going to talk about one woman who I had a great affection for as I read about her. She's called Marie-Aimée Régnier. Marie-Aimée Régnier, R-E-G-N-I-E-R, who's a blind woman, French teacher at the Institute for Young Blind People until 1906. She was born in 1850. 52 in the French countryside in the Eure department. And from birth, she had two congenital cataracts, and she grew in a well-off family. And thanks to a nun, she received help, and according to her, she became a good Christian. And like most female teachers at the time, blind teachers, she lived in an educational institution and she remained single all her life. And she was an active member of the association, and as far as I can see, she was one of the first women who took action to improve the lot of blind women. She doesn't define herself as a feminist, but a lot of her actions do have feminist goals. She wanted to foster the independence and autonomy of blind women and reduce inequalities that were suffered with respect to blind men, for example, education, access to employment. And one of the first actions she undertook was that she provided information to young girls who were leaving the institute about the difficulties they were going to encounter. She gave them advice to present themselves well when they went to apply for a job, how to get into contact with sighted people. And there's an important aspect that we see in her personality, which is that she's a woman who was obliged by her circumstances to live in the boarding school. She was single, but she had the aspiration to be independent. She was the first teacher to ask to be allowed to live outside the school, outside the Institute for Blind Youth. And she asked the headmaster if she could, and first of all, he refused that, because the headmaster wanted to keep the blind teachers in the boarding school so that they would be available for their pupils, that they wouldn't get married, because marriage for blind women was a dangerous thing. And also, from the point of view of the institute, keeping them in the boarding school allowed them to pay them less, because they deducted all the living costs from their salaries. And so the sources that I was been able to consult, I saw that Marie-Aimée Regnier did everything she could for her pupils and gave them desire to frequent the ordinary world and give them more freedom. But in what she says, she's aware of reality and the fact that young blind girls would have huge difficulties to find a sighted husband or to live outside the institutes. And so, for example, in a small book called The Small Bird of the Sisters, for which she wrote for her pupils, she talks about the reaction of a blind heroine when she learns that one of her companions is become engaged. And the heroine says, "Blindness is a burden. Our life is dark, obscure, and joyless, but I'm 21 and I don't want to get old behind bars. I want to go out into the world, whatever it costs. I don't want to be in custody. I don't want to be the only one to live in traditions. I'm fed up. I want to live something else. I want to feel that I'm alive here and now." And so that is one of her first actions, and from 1921, 1922 onwards, she developed new actions and spoke at a national conference to improve the conditions for blind people, where she defends the rights of blind women. And another important fact in 1922 is that she founded the first association of blind women called Mutual Female Help, with the goal of fighting against isolation and loneliness for blind women by providing care and solutions for their material and moral needs. And so this association provided help, either monetary or material, for example, giving wool to blindness that they could knit. It also gave them grants for them to be able to go on, so that the teachers could go on holiday, because they lived in a boarding school, to go and get some fresh air during the holidays. And Marie-Aimée Régnier defended an important right at the time, which was the right for blind girls to have teaching, because blind girls at the time didn't have this teaching, because at that time the institution didn't want them to become housewives, because they were afraid if they gave them this kind of teaching, they would want to get married, and the desire was that they wouldn't get married. And Marie-Aimée Régnier also defended access to work and access to fair pay for blind musicians, and also defended the fact that blind women were allowed to be elegant. But like most blind intellectuals at the time that looked at blind women, they all said the same thing, that blind women needed to be elegant and attractive. There was this obligation to overplay their femininity in order to exist in their humanity. So she would also defend the creation non-mixed living conditions for women, and she also defended the individualization of living areas in hospices and workshops. So that is a very succinct way of by mentioning her in an article. She doesn't talk about this in her national conferences, but in articles that she publishes, she does mention this. And so what struck me was most feminists in the first wave, Marie-Aimée Régnier, doesn't talk about motherhood to win over new rights for blind women. And I think that this silence is explained by the desire to be more convincing based on common sense that blind women have to remain single. Like a lot of intellectuals at the time, she was convinced that the situation of blind women was deplorable for most of them. There was a lot to be done, and that there should be small steps taken in the claims made. Where other people might have different opinion to me. And so that is to say that Marie-Aimée Régnier combines in her actions, she doesn't fight for rights but for social help, but that does have a tangible impact by fostering leisure activities for blind women, autonomy, professional authority, with fighting for rights, but which doesn't have a major profile. And so this led me recently to putting forward the fact that insignificant actions can have a much bigger value. For example, copying music scores in Braille for other blind women, or describing an article to advise the parents of blind children to buy certain things for Christmas presents. And all of this does play of a role, but each time supports a feminist vision, in my opinion. And that's to say that Marie-Aimée Régnier embodies a form of feminism that is influenced by Catholicism. And another error I made when the first time I read my sources was that I was looking to find a movement for the rights of blind women, so blind feminism. But the more I read the sources, the more I criticise them, and the more I'm convinced that there were several blind feminists at the time. And there was a Republican feminism that defended equal pay for blind men and blind women. Thank you.
thank you, Shridas, for this presentation. And now I want to hand over to our other two participants, Virginia Kastrup, who's a professor at Professor University of Rio de Janeiro, and she's doing a doctoral thesis on subjectivity in clinical psychology, also research in cognitive psychology, holds a doctorate in clinical psychology that she got at the University of Sao Paulo, and a master in psychology that she got in 1993 from Rio de Janeiro Federal University in 2001-2002, she was in a postdoctoral program in Paris, and between 2009-2010, a postdoctoral research position in another institution, presenting with Rafael Guerrero, who is a clinical psychologist holding a master's in psychology and a doctor in social and institutional psychology at the Federal University of Rio Grande do Sul, and a member of NUCC, which is a research center at the Federal University of Rio de Janeiro. The title of this paper is Narratives of Handicaps, the embodied words from non-hegemonic bodies. It's over to you. Thank you, Corinne. I'm going to start. Greetings to you all. My name is Virginia Kastrup. I'm Brazilian, and I'm talking to you from Rio de Janeiro. I'm a white-sighted woman, 66 years old, curly hair with blonde curls. I've got a red dress on. I'm also wearing glasses. I'm in my office in front of my bookshelves. I'm a research lecturer in cognitive psychology, and my work is at the boundary between art and blindness. Look at the creative process in an ceramics workshop in a major institution for the rehabilitation and education of visually impaired people. Also research into accessibility on the blind to arts museums. The concept of aesthetic accessibility, emphasizing the importance of the tactile aesthetic experience and motor sensory experience. And I've headed up a project for the Rio Museum of Modern Art multi-sensory event, where we are staged diffuse group visits with sighted and non-sighted people to share experience. And we have other avenues of research, such as tactile mental images, dreams of the congenitally blind, and verbalism, all of which relates to the importance of the embodied words of non-sighted people in blindness studies. In terms of methods, I, with Marcia Moral, look at the concept of researching with, so a type of participatory research, and to do that I use a distinctive type of interview to have first person experience of non-sighted people and how they speak and their narratives, and there is a big challenge for researchers who are cited to have access to and express experience or experiences of blindness, which is why I use this co-research method and participatory interviews. But I think this results in an approximation, but where there is still a gap between the experience of the non-sighted individual and academic outputs on the subject. But that is the challenge that we need to address in order to communicate about this experience. Francisco Varela has been a major influence on my work in cognitive psychology, looking at what are the cognitive systems at work in sighted and non-sighted individuals, and that these emerge from a process of production of practical cognitive experiences. An action has an ontological dimension, and I think that this approach, it helps to deconstruct the idea that there is a natural, spontaneous way of apprehending our environment, which is the visual method, and a strange, bizarre approach adopted by non-sighted individuals who would allegedly perceive through other senses in secondary, less efficient, less noble ways than vision. So I look at all those types of issue, but the paper that I've written with Raquel, who will also be speaking a little more about the paper, looks at the significance of embodied narratives in the context of academic output based on the experience of blindness and other disabilities. And this is both an individual and a collective experience. Irrespective of whether we experience disability, there is a challenge when it comes to obtaining embodied narratives in research output, research literature. So that's where I'm at. We're looking at these, what is a new issue for you, and I think it's quite interesting. This question, what Gildas has said, has opened up the fields in quite an interesting way, and there'll be lots to talk about as a result. Thank you. Thank you for this presentation. It will be very interesting to begin a conversation after the other presentation. We are also hearing from Anaïs Chouibale, who is a doctoral student in philosophy.
Non, c'est moi.
No, sorry, you've already introduced me. It's Raquel who will be.
C'est moi, je suis désolée.
Sorry, my mistake. Sorry, I thought there was just one speaker on your part, so my apologies. I'll hand over to Raquel first so that she can take up from there. Thank you. Greetings to you all. My name is Raquel Guerreiro. I'm a sighted woman, white woman, with dark brown eyes, long brown. brown hair and a white wall behind me. And I'm speaking to you from Rio de Janeiro, and I'm very happy to be part of this event. And I'm going to time with what other participants in the roundtable have been saying. We're looking at how we can have a positive image of blindness and other disabled experiences can be constructed. We are talking about research papers and how they are written and how we can write about disabled experience, be it in the first person when the researcher themselves is disabled, or in the third person when the researcher is not disabled. So I have a master's in psychology and PhD in social psychology, and I work with visually impaired people and have done for the past 10 years, and did that in aesthetic sensitivity of blind people in art museums and cultural centres, and a project of aesthetic accessibility in various cultural centres. I've done a criticism of mimetism of others' visual abilities, because often this is a way that people approach alternative sensory experiences. I've also been in touch with, looked at how disabled women have interacted with feminist movements. I have a neurological disease which affects my movements, so I could identify with that. This is it's called Inclusivasa, feminist movement for disabled women. There is a major local political engagement on the part of this movement to fight for the right of disabled women locally. This is not a very large scale movement. It is attempting to reach out to other feminist groups of more with a more broader scope of action, because there are, of course, common concerns with broader feminist actions. And in this group, Les Inclusivas, which I was part of for 2 years, they found it was difficult to reach out to other groups, because the Inclusivas said that other feminist groups excluded them. And also said that it was very important to raise their own profile, because there were questions that related solely to disabled women. So this was clearly a political issue. In addition, this group was quite diverse. There were different types of disabilities, which was good in terms of discussing our approaches to a given issue. And from there, my research broadened out to extend to other aspects of disability, including a feminist critic and grip theory, which has begun to affect sociology research in Brazil when I came across live writing for example, in feminism, first-person narratives of disabled, own voice narratives of these disabled women became my subject of research. And I went back to this when I wrote my PhD thesis. And in terms of becoming, as it were, a disabled woman, my diagnosis was quite late. I realized the importance of confronting this idea of a normal or normative body, which is that of an able-bodied individual. And in academic research, there's not much said about normative body experiences, including those on the part of the researcher themselves. So, but Vanessa Ward raised a question at one panel debate: how can we do more or do things differently? Blindness cannot be restricted to the a specific lack of a specific faculty. I think we need to broaden out this discussion of visual disability to other types of disability, even if they have various particularities. We have questions that are similar, such as the deconstruction of what a normative body is and the diversity of bodies and the different ways of living our lives. Thank you, Raquel, for this fascinating contribution, which we will come back to. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions about this. So now I'm going to hand the floor to Anaïs Chouet-Vallée, who is a doctoral student in philosophy at the University of Lyon 3. She also has a therapeutic approach. Her paper is about is a letter from a blind person to those who are a carer. So, Anaïs, the floor is yours.
So, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Anaïs Chouet-Vallée. I'm a white woman. I'm 29. I have fair hair, and I have them up in bun, but a tight bun because it's very hot here in Lyon. I have dark brown eyes, almond-shaped eyes. I'm dressed in a black dress, but you can only see the top of it. I have a lot of tattoos on my chest, on my arms and neck, and they're mainly plants and insects in the tattoos. Some also my face, my ears, but that's all about me to describe me. I'm a PhD student in philosophy at the CNRS and the University of Lyon 3. At the same time, I also practice shiatsu therapy, therapeutic massage from Japan, which uses acupressure and practices taken from osteopathy, dealing with joints. I work in my research on touch in treatments, and so female epistemologists. I have gradually in my research included disability studies, who finished by discovering the association between disability studies and feminist epistemologists through what we call in French handy feminism, disabled feminism, or feminist disability studies in English, on feminist disabilities, which is one branch of critical disability studies. in order to be able to look at the way in which knowledge or different forms of knowledge on the body are constructed based on a hegemonic approach, which is oculocentric. Oculocentric approach. I'll say more about that later. And to show to the extent to which this hegemonic construction of medical knowledge and scientific knowledge of the body also involves a sexist and patriarchal domination, and uses a very restrictive definition of what the body is, what sensitivity is, sensations are, and also a very minimalist definition of vulnerability based on disability studies and critical feminist studies on disability. I intend to criticize this notion of vulnerability at the heart of the treatment relationships and the touch relationship in treatment, showing that the classical conception of vulnerability is itself suffers or affected by prejudices, or ableist prejudice, as well as very sexist prejudices. I'm sorry, I just need to open up my document. I forgot to say that I'm blind, and it appears that people are saying to me that people can't see that I'm blind, and so able-bodied people, sighted people are surprised that they can't see that I'm blind, which raises the question of the visibility of disabilities. And so this round table allows me to say that my research is in disability studies with feminist disability, on studies based on theories and everything relating to positioning theories, the standpoint theories, the fact that you can look at where people are speaking from, who's speaking, and what the social position, the cultural position of the person that is the one who's producing a scientific knowledge. And depending on the social position that you occupy, you won't produce knowledge in the same way, depending on your gender or your whether or not you're able-bodied or not. You have a perspective of knowledge that will be different, and which will result in a different methodology to deal with knowledge. And so this raises question about objectiveness. Well, what is objectiveness? Can we keep the same definition of that? And so I'm in a feminist stream that tends to say, yes, objectivity can exist, but we need to add to what the objectivity that is that of cisgendered white males, and usually able-bodied men, sighted men, because objectiveness, as it is traditionally used, relies on visual factors of being distanced from an object to be able to observe it. So the separation between the subject and the object of knowledge, and you also need to be neutral, so not involved with your object. And so starting off with a physical contact between bodies in treatment, the notion of distance can't be maintained very well. And that's why I would like to develop a perspective on treatment and caring that criticizes oculocentrism, whilst including module based on Touch, but which doesn't aim to replace the sense of touch for that of sight, but to open the door to a form of a concept that I use, that I mobilize, which is that of the a feeling body. I've referred a lot to the work of Marion Ng that we listened to earlier, and in particular her concept of a practico sensitive a body is not just a sensory body, it's also a body that hears discourses, injunctions, social relationships, and the notion of sensitivity and feeling will take into account the diversity of definitions that we can give to the body, and the diversity of definitions that we can use to talk about the body and the vulnerable body. Oculocentrism, as I see it, the visiocentrism is not necessarily the eye that is a fault here, but it's the question of the sense that is favoured over and above the others. Sight becomes predominant, and hearing too. But I'm looking at sight in particular. It's not the sense of sight as such, but it's a very restrictive definition of what sight is. Sight is a sense that is desensorized, and you remove the sensory notion to make it into a model of scientific value. And so it's a certain definition of sight that we use in the way we construct sciences and medical knowledge, which then directs the way we do research and provide or reveal knowledge about the body. And so my aim is based on this knowledge or intimate knowledge of the body, experiences in the body, how we can rethink vulnerability, which doesn't take for granted the distance required by visual centrism. And so this very little we often hear about in care theory is that it's that of people that we need to take care of, the people being cared for, rather than the people who are giving the care. And this definition of vulnerability is very able-centric, because it's able-bodied people who are taking care of non-able-bodied people. And so to be able to think of non-able people as carers becomes very complicated. And now I'm referring to work by Marion Douay, who should have been in the next roundtable, but isn't here today, unfortunately, who's done a lot of work on parenthood of blind people and motherhood of blind women. And to get round to the suspicion of incompetence, blind mothers have to perform gender norms and heteronormative standards as they're constructed traditionally in a heterosexual couple, where it's the mother is the main caregiver, looking after the body and the bringing up the children. And these blind mothers are suspected of not being able to take care of others because they receive care themselves. And so this enables us to look at the question of being able. If you're not able, does that mean that you can't be in charge, or looking after another person who's not able. And so that makes me think of what Corinne Toria said in the opening speech of this conference. In general, being partially sighted depends on a certain model, whereas in fact thinking about blindness in the light of a social model with social relationships between people, that allows us to get away from naturalizing definitions of what blindness is. And here, I think it's possible to cultivate this blind culture in a perspective of empowerment and getting away from the traditional approaches, ableist approaches, which I find in a lot of associations or a lot of discourse on visual disabilities. We need to get away from being visio-centric, which focuses people's attention on their scientific view. I've just used my hands talking about scientific way of seeing things and the question of touching things and physical contact as I've studied it and as I use it in my research, enables us to get a different idea of the interaction between bodies and the incarnation of caring, which is present in a social and institutional framework that needs to be taken into account when we study these things. And that's why I use an epistemological approach, which calls all this into question in order not to idealize the question of touch in the care relationship when it's not removed from a visual-centric model. And there can be a lot of violence in this, the medical violence, gynecological violence, which comes through touch. But it's because they're done in a certain setting where the aim is to create a distance with the feelings of the body. And so they're not thought of as being violent because the aim is to get knowledge about the body. And so maybe, and you're saying a lot of very interesting things. I'm very grateful to have included Marion's talk. We've had two the destructural roundtable, and I think you're raising all the issues that we could have talked about, but I'm sorry to have to stop you. Maybe I could now ask to conclude and then hand over to Corinne, who will be presiding this session, and we invite the audience to stay with us until 6:45, because the roundtable will be prolonged because we've reorganized things. So Anaïs, maybe you could finish what you were saying in one sentence, and then Corinne can. So thank you. I don't know if I can summarize what I was going to say. What I want to talk about in my presentation, but what I suggest in my research is to look at epistemology from a contact point rather than a point of view, and to think about interactions and the place of the body in the way we construct knowledge. And that's why I suggest in an article that I published last year, a letter of a blind person to carers, in order to parody the famous text by Diderot, who wrote the letter about blind people to carers. And so to look at things from a touch point of view in the care, in the treatment relationship.
So Corinne, now over to you. Thank you. Thank you, Selina. Thank you to Anaïs for this very interesting presentation. And in fact, it will be quite a difficult exercise for me to comment. We want to be able to try and cover the major issues that have emerged. Without overgeneralizing, I think that what has been highlighted in all three instances is that when you approach the issue of disability and blindness studies from a feminist perspective, we have to address the issue of different areas of oppression where the subjects of research have historically been confronted. In particular, living in an oculocentric, visiocentric society, which takes masculinity as the in biological, social, cultural terms, and therefore the deconstruction and reconstruction needs to take place. I think that what was particularly interesting in this panel discussion, or is interesting in this panel discussion, is that speakers have all highlighted various methodological approaches which might allow us to study these issues, Gildas. In your research, we see the benefit and significance of study these issues from a historical perspective, the period that you've been looking in at in French history is one of the richest and most important in terms of the general compression, in terms of activism of disabled, in particular the blind. We were talking about the veterans of the Great War in a previous session. And here, activities that disabled individuals were involved at this watershed moment in French history still deserve further research in greater detail to really dig up everything which is of interest in this period. What I found particularly interesting in your paper is the fact that you look at a particular individual without making her a heroine, and from a perspective of a professional historian, that is very complex feat to pull off. But looking at an individual can avoid thinking of activism solely in terms of collective actions and to consider it also in terms of individual contributions. This individual-based approach also highlights a whole series of issues which perhaps would not have come out so clearly looked at from a collective point of view. For example, the issue of how blind women's identity, particularly teachers, was constructed or is constructed. The history of Marie Régnier is a way of comprehending the framework in which these women's identity had to emerge, feeling all sorts of pressure from a society which had a specific set of expectations, not only of women, but also of blind women, and that she did not simply lie down and accept these expectations, and her and others did not simply accept these, but took them as challenges. And this approach enabled Régnier and those influenced by her engagement to embark on establishing personal identity, which hitherto had not been there to take hold of. When it comes to what Virginia and Raquel told us, what I found fascinating in their research is that not only that there's the methodological approach that they have adopted in their work, but also the significance of case studies on which they have focused. Their research resonates not only with disability studies, but also makes a major contribution to medical humanities with a research archive which could considerably inform disability studies and create subjects for dialogue with our current field of research. When it comes to identity and visual handicap, that emerged from your contributions, from my perspective as historian, raises interesting research issues those who are interested in clinical psychology will find them perhaps self-evident, but for someone from my discipline they do not immediately spring to mind. So I found it very stimulating to hear about this research and your comments on it, because multidisciplinary, interdisciplinary cooperation between historians and clinical psychologists would be something of great value in terms of providing a contribution to these fields of research. And finally, a few words about what Anaïs told us about and her research. I think her contribution is also very significant with regard to medical humanities, and the fact that Anaïs, you also have a shiatsu massage activity, gives a whole another series of insights and experiences which are important for this research field. And your paper also brought to mind once again the issue of identity frameworks and categories that we use or that we refer to that we wouldn't normally think of. And another thing which came to mind is that we live in a world which sees able-bodiedness as the default position and sighted bodies as default, and also the male body as the default value, all of which raises the issue of how to educate people in the fact that female bodies, non-sighted bodies, disabled bodies may be legitimately constructed in a way that is different to the perceived default value or default norm. And I think this is one of the perhaps biggest shortcomings that needs to be addressed when we look at the field of disability studies, and particularly from a feminist perspective. So with that in mind, I would like to ask our traditional three questions which underpin our conference, and so perhaps you would like to respond in the order in which you originally took the floor to give your brief responses to these questions. So the first of these is, how do you position your research within disability studies and more generally within the field of disability? Well, I look at French research into disability studies, not all of it, but some of it. I appreciate Catherine Kodwitz, David Bolt, talking about variations on oculocentrism, that the blind was a variation on this, and that prevented me from making over hasty generalizations. And as a historian, I don't attempt to read all the literature on a topic, but I first look at sources and attempt to consult a great many sources so that I am not affected by current research, which is often quite far removed from historical realities and their local particularities. So I try not to dig around or read around, but look at the sources and then connect those with reading as we go along. So I'm also looking at disability history, if you like, rather within critical disability studies, but I haven't adopted a particular theory. I do try to be reflective and take into account work from political science and sociology to interpret the past, but that said, I always take the view that sources are much more eloquent than the sociological interpretation that current affairs might lend to them. Thank you, Gildas. Virginia, would you like to add your insight? Yeah, you're muted at the moment. So, disability studies, feminist studies, second generation feminist studies, or second generation disability studies. My speciality is perhaps more cognitive psychology, because that's a very open discipline in Brazil, very intersectional. And so I'm not for the biomedical model, which some cognitive psychology tends to be, working with neuroscientists and so on. In Brazil, we are not restricted to that. We are also influenced by, say, Michel Foucault's work, we studied Michel Foucault, Gilles Deleuze, Félix Guattari, and other non-professional psychologists, shall we say. So that would clearly put us on the disability studies side of things. Thank you, Virginia. Raquel, anything to add to that? Yes, I would say disability studies with the feminist criticism, and I would also be in line with CRIP theory. This is a US theory here.
Le texte de disability studies, ils ont été traduits par...
Disability studies literature is quite recent. Deborah Jinnish is an anthropologist, and she translated a lot of this at the end of the... in around 2007, which... we then had the literature in Portuguese. And just anthropology, but very recently, 5 years ago, even less, we started to broaden out the dissemination of this literature. So it's actually quite recent. And feminism... feminism as regards to disability is very much a work in progress in Brazil. We're trying to put this together with the, as I mentioned, the disability women's movements, disabled women's movement, and also in academia, we take up issues for discussion at the academic level, and I am still really at that, well, in that way of thinking. And I would like to be interested to learn about other authors, French-speaking authors, which we don't really have access to here as yet. Thank you. Thank you, Raquel.
As I said quickly earlier, I'm in critical disability studies, which show that disability studies as they appeared in the 70s tended to minimize the bodily experience of the first person, giving them a disability, even if it's socially constructed, but the inability of society to accept physical diversity. And that's what critical disability studies and feminist disability studies have showed. And so in the French speaking world, we call this, it's called handy feminism. And here there are several people at the conference in the network that is in this network of studies, working at looking at the gender issues in disability. And this is an international French-speaking network that deals with the different issues relating to disability and research into gender and disability. And to take a more materialistic approach to these questions, and looking at the effects of domination on the body, and that's why I prefer to talk about the intertwining of our struggles. Some people talk about intersectionality. I don't use this word because I'm not talking about racial issues, and that's a political tool that talks about the effects of racism, classism, and sexism. So, but I don't want to take the political aspect of this away by using it to talk about disability. But I want to talk about the interplay of critical of power struggles in critical disability studies. So thank you for this answer to the first question. Now to ask the second question, how do you describe blindness studies? Who would like to speak first?
Tu peux le rétablir, merci.
Switch your mic on.
En fait, pour moi, c'est l'ensemble des études interdisciplinaires.
For me, it's all the interdisciplinary studies on the specific experiences of the social life with visual impairment. And it's, for me, it's also studies that call into question all unilateral interpretations that are pejorative with respect to blindness. And so we need to pay attention to the diversity of life experience of blind people or visually impaired vessel and the role of blind people in constructing story. And I think we really do need to talk about autonomy and take into account that aspect. And so I would tend to remove from this field studies on blindness or critical blindness studies that don't take into account or don't seek to take into account the hopes and aspirations and claims or that don't listen to the people concerned. Thank you, Gilda. Virginia now. I think that blindness studies are it's a study network and it's interdisciplinary or even transdisciplinary that will be able to present or will seek to develop a positive conception of blindness and talking about diversity of the ways in which you can be blind and to live with blindness. So positivity, diversity are two elements which I believe are specific to the field of blindness studies. And another thing is the role of protagonists of blind people in the construction of this field. Protagonism is the positioning of problems. What are the most important problems? And to be, it's present also needs to be guaranteed in methodology. But that's what I think are the issues to construct this idea. Thank you, Virginia. What about you, Raquel? Sorry. I agree with Virginia. I also think about protagonism in the construction of this field of study, and blind people need to deconstruct the negative image of blindness and work on positive aspects. But I also think that we need to underscore the political reasons for this. For example, with Virginia, I've already worked with her previously, and we worked on the notion of cognitive psychology, but there's also blindness, and we worked on tact and music, etc. But there's a very political dimension to this type of study. So we need all we to be attentive to the political dimension of what we're putting forward and to see how we do this, the methodology that we use. We need to be pay attention to that. Thank you, Raquel. Anaïs. I think the definition that I would give to blindness studies is the ability to create an interdisciplinary social model of blindness in the same way as this was done for disability in general, which implies, and I here agree with Raquel and Virginia on the positive definition of blindness, which implies empowerment and, as Judas said too, making blind people agents. And we also need to look at how knowledge about blind people and their experience, we also need to take blindness as a subject in the same way that we used to remove from the history of ideas the scientific production of women. It can also be an invitation to look again at the scientific production made by blind or non-sighted people. But the positive definition of blindness is, I would also add a negative definition, which is that that allows us to pool the experiences of expression and ableist domination and oculocentric domination to be a condition to be able to create empowerment, and also to become aware of the structural mechanisms that mean that society is unadapted for blindness rather than the other way around. Thank you. So now I'm going to ask the third and final question. What definition of blindness does your research or your experience lead you to adopt? Gildas, as a historian, I don't use a single definition of blindness because the definition of blindness varies depending on territories and times in history. But I admit that I made the mistake quite often of not having given a prior definition to the study that I was doing. I take the definition that I find in my sources, in administrative documents, but I've always tried in my research to find a plurality of definition of blindness and experience of blindness and what's at stake in this category. So I've looked, for example, at the ways in which blind people identify themselves collectively and individually. Do blind people identify themselves in the category of the infirm, or do they refuse that category? So I try to pay attention to the fluidity of these identifications. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So the same question for you, Virginia. It's the positive definition of blindness, perceiving and seeing with other senses that aren't sight. That's what blindness is. That's the most positive definition, I believe. I agree with Bertrand Vérin, who talked about it in that way, and I believe that's a good definition. It's getting away from the idea of there being something lacking and saying things in a positive way. Let's see how we can live and perceive with other senses. Thank you. Raquel.
Thank you.
For me, blindness is not something that I can defy. I agree with Gildas, but I think that I see blindness as an experience.
Complètement différent.
An experience the world that is.
C'est une autre chose. C'est une forme d'être au monde.
But it's something else. It's a form of existing in the world.
And I think
that when we see normality as being having a body,
on fait que la pluralité elle soit
oui
apparaît.
Reduce plurality.
So
I think that we
need notion de normalité, de corps
to get away from this idea of normality as having a normal body, being a body that sees. So I'm sorry because I don't have all the vocabulary to express things or to see blindness in a different way. Thank you, Anaïs. Astakel,
I comme une expérience à la identify with the du coup intime, subjective.
Finish on blindness as a sensory experience. It's intimate. It's also a social experience.
Sociale, des structures de pouvoir. Et du coup, ce qui fait que
power structures, and so that means that blindness for me is a label that we might want to use to have access to rights, to have access to things that to make society to adapt to blind or visually impaired people, but it's also a risk to find yourself assigned to that particular category. And so this comes back to what we said, the Wollstonecraft paradox. Wollstonecraft, which means that we can claim a minority identity to get rights, but we also run the risk of being relegated to that status. And so then what's at stake is to look at the have a reversal of stigma to see how you can make that into something that's strong and something that can give you a form of power. And that's why I find that the feminist epistemologists can be very useful to see blindness as Samuel Harding and Nancy Harding said, call epistemic
privilege.
So blindness gives a kind of privilege, a social privilege, a scientific privilege, epistemological privilege to perceive the way in a different way, which is different from the usual perception that we people want to reduce us to, and so to look at the world in a different way and open a new body.
Merci Anaïs, merci à.
Thank you, Anaïs. Thank you, everybody, for having shared their research and having answered our key questions in the conference. Now I'm going to hand over to Céline, who's going to moderate the question and answer session. Céline, over to you. Thank you very much. I'd like to congratulate you on your performance in this roundtable, Corinne, and also that of the participants for their answers, concise but very precise answers to the three questions. All the answers have locked in very well together, so thank you for this great work. I can see that we already have a hand raised. It's Hannah. Don't hesitate, the other participants, either to raise your hand to ask your question, or you can do it virtually or in front of your screen if you prefer. Hannah, over to you to ask the first question. Thank you very much, Céline, and thank you to the speakers, and thank you for having accepted this reorganisation at the last minute. You've understood that two of the speakers in the 12th roundtable can't be with us, are not able to be with us. And so we've taken the decision to put Anaïs into this session, and then we're going to explain to you what will happen later. My question is, first of all for Anaïs, but it's relates to the work of each of you, and it's a methodological question. In your article, because I've read it attentively, you talked about the located criticism, and my question is, in your article, you talk about the work of Marion Douai, who should have been a speak with you in the next session, and she too is a blind woman who works on blind women. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you navigate the complicated situation that occurs when you're a researcher and also the subject of the research? And I'm also in this category myself, because I'm also a blind woman working on blindness. But I'm asking the same question to Raquel too. How do you navigate this complicated positioning, Anaïs? So first of all, it's up to you to answer, and then Raquel. As far as I'm concerned, I think that it's a struggle, and particular in with a facility which is a subject in France which is very general, very detached from material issues. Often philosophy is hard to define as a human science. But my approach is to integrate myself into a field of philosophy and to say, even though I'm a philosopher, I don't have to work in a library. And so I go out into the field. I've done an observation of participants in groups of feminists. But I also practice autoethnography. And so methodologically, I have to justify that and explain what it is, because it's not always a well-known approach in philosophy. And then conceptually, what's at stake for me is to criticize, in both senses of the word, to call into question and to define the objectivity, and to say that it isn't a contradictory to subjectivity, and that we very often hear that a person who is concerned by the subject of research,
aveuglé,
blinded, I'm sorry for the pun.
Voilà, comme si en fait j'étais littéralement aveuglée par
moi. So I was literally blinded en fait, by my blindness. And so
dotée d'outils.
I have taken on tools,
standpoint in theories.
Particular from standpoint theories, to say that
de dire que subjectivité et objectivité sont objectivity en opposition.
Et on objectivity are mutually exclusive. Subjectivity feeds into objectivity. And as being objectivity is seen as being neutral, but it doesn't really exist. A person or somebody who's in a social position thing,
la notion d'objectivity,
enrich,
strong objectivity,
and that's the a notion of strong objectivity.
Saisissons-nous de ces diversités et de ces multiplicités de perspectives sur le
which means that we can get hold of the. These diverse perceptions of reality in order to have a varied discourse which is as faithful as possible to what the actual situation is for a person. Thank you very much, Anaïs. It's really very interesting. And that goes back to what you were saying earlier about when I had to interrupt you, unfortunately. So thank you for that. And I think, Raquel, you also have a very interesting.
Merci pour la question. Moi, je suis avec Anaïs.
Yes, I agree with Anaïs. It's a challenge because
il y a une féministe brésilienne qui dit qu'il faut.
And there's a Brazilian feminist who said you have to do research on yourself.
Moi, j'utilise.
That's a challenge. And I use a method that we use a lot here in Brazil, which is a cartographical method, which a mapping approach, but it's been developed by a Brazilian author, and this is an intervention method. And so the body of the researcher is always at issue, it's always in the field. And so it affects the field, and the field affects it. And so we can't do research without taking into account and the body of the researcher. And so for me, doing research means that there's this aspect of being in the field, and as we say, we do research with the body, with our bodies. Our research is dirtied by our work, but it's also a risk because as we have these impressions in the first person, we need to be attentive to make sure that it doesn't become a diary, a personal diary. We need to do our research from the body, but not on our own body, but using our body. It's incarnated. It's a challenge for me. For example, I can feel
la méthode de la recherche, donc
into the research method, and so I had to do this because all of the research was done in this way. I stumbled, and stumbling is when you meet people, because when you stumble, you meet other possibilities. And so this is a way of taking research as a way of telling a particular standpoint. It's a challenge.
Thank you both for having explained where your research fits, and this idea of tripping up, of course, is significant for research in general, and we understand by what you mean by embodied perspectives, using the body and not simply talking about the body. So thank you to both of you for answering this question. And Marion has raised her hand, and I'll let you ask your question straight away. Thank you, Céline. Marion Chiotin. There are quite a few Marions here, actually. And I wanted to thank all of you because I think all of the contributions here are decisive and crucial and should occupy a central position in blindness studies. My question is about the text, which a paper which Anaïs brought, coming back to a question that has been raised previously, which is that of touch. And at the very start of your paper, you talk about Vincent Lufaut. It's V-I-N-C-E-T and then hyphen B-A. U-F-F-E-T, I think. Didn't capture all that. I think so. The rehabilitation, where there's ambivalence of touch in Western society, contemporary Western societies, because touch accessories are developing after somewhat of a veil of silence. And you said that the 20th century suggests that an illusory liberation of sensory norms articulated around the interiorization of these same norms is, and you think that this interiorization has neoliberal ideology components. And I had this instinct, but I don't really know much more about it, and I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about ambivalence of rehabilitation because of neoliberal undercurrents. Thank you for having read my paper so closely. In terms of ambivalent rehabilitation of such, this will resonate with Virginia and Raquel, I believe. There's this idea of disciplining bodies, as Foucault would say, where actions are internalized and presented as norms, and ambivalent rehabilitation of touch is about how some touch just actions can be internalized. They may be seen as relegated to the private sphere or the medical sphere, and the ambivalence resides in the fact that there's a whole aspect of non-verbal communication which is applied in company management that draws on experimental psychology research to demonstrate the degree to which physical contact, touch, encourages a sense of trust and efficiency when somebody is touched, and management techniques in companies sometimes exploit these studies into touch to apply them in a high-line management context under the guise of non-verbal communication to establish what is comes across as a non-hierarchical relationship. But this is always implemented in one direction, not the other. So, for example, in public state hospitals in France, public hospitals are increasingly being managed. In other words, managed as companies. Superiors, often doctors, have the power to touch their inferiors, and female nurses, often it's female nurses being touched by male doctors. And as Marion was saying, and Hoffman had already identified this in the 50s, this is still the case today. And in fact, it is a way of establishing power structures in companies. Touch is exploited by non-verbal communication strategies, which is why I talked about neoliberal exploitation to, in other words, to make the company work better, which echoes Emily Hash's work on neoliberal governmental practices. It talks about governmentality and bodily internalization with power plays, which refer to Monica Greco, who this is a US author, I believe, who has worked on the definition and care for so-called psychosomatic diseases, which resonate with this issue of neoliberal governmentality of bodies and touch in the care relationship. Also relates a lot to the definition of psychosomatic diseases and effective traditional medicine. The lack of traditional medical responses mean that people think it's all in the mind, and that the person therefore needs support, which often takes the form of touch. As a shiatsu practitioner, I believe that touch can, of course, help, but it can also be used by hegemonic medical discourse to, in fact, compensate for a failure on the part of conventional medicine. And I hope that my response is clear. Absolutely, Thank you very much, Anais, which leads me to think of the various forms of practice of yoga that is now being imposed by companies to exploit people in the sense of increasing their performance. And I've always detested that practice. So thank you for that insight. Thank you very much for this very specific question and answer, which opens up interesting avenues. Thank you again, all of you, for pointing out that your how you've situated your research and answered the audience's questions. I think we've probably extended this panel discussion about as much as we can. Thank you again to our interpreters and also the contributions spontaneously and beforehand on the part of Corinne to bring this all together. Thank you for having engaged in the discussion with the Q&A session with a large number of panelists. So my thanks. And what I will now do is hand the floor to Hannah so that she can help us to know what is going to happen next.